Well, hey, everyone. For this week's culture segment, I am very privileged to be in the studio with Dr. Dan Allender. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa.
Many of you folks out there know Dan, probably for a number of different reasons. He's written just a ridiculous number of books. First
ridiculous.
Of all,
some that is so well said.
This is what I don't understand.
You're basically a fool.
Well, I don't understand how all these people who are like counselors have time to write all these books. So either you're just literally like coming out of a session with someone and writing what happened there, or the other that's not feasibly, it's not possible.
I do a lot of my writing in airports, planes, trains, and automobiles. So,
right.
You know, rather than
traveling to and fro,
staring out a window, I play with words.
Okay. So apparently these folks write when... You know, I just figured you were discovering another, you know, a new thing about like the human psyche or something, but you're just writing books.
Watching so, you in airports. Right. That's what I'm doing.
Okay. That's good. I do that too, but I haven't written about it yet. So, well, Dan has written, like I said, many of you have read The Wounded Heart or some of his other books, obviously Intimate Allies and The Healing Path. He's written with Larry Crabb. He used to be here in Colorado until we kicked him out, and he ended up in Seattle as the founder and once president of Mars Hill Graduate School. Also written a lot with Tremper Longman.
Yes,
so,
and the school now being called the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology.
Seattle, name change, Seattle School. Okay. So, but he is here today. I only have a few minutes with him before he's going to go fly fishing. So obviously he has his priorities straight and he'll just be done with us. But we are very privileged because he, I'm sure, has a few things to say to us as young adults. And I'm excited to hear this because you have a long, long history, Dan, of mentoring and speaking into the lives of folks, including young adults. And that's certainly the, I actually went out to Seattle and visited a couple friends who attended the school there and had the chance to hear Dan teach a little bit. So, and I think you just have a passion for people and for truth and for beauty. You and I were talking a little bit about this.
Plus, I have a 31-year-old daughter, and I have a 27-year-old daughter and a 23-year-old son. So I'm immersed, as any parent is, in trying to figure out the world I live in.
Yeah, which is interesting because when I speak on behalf of Boundless, I find that I'm speaking to one of two audiences. I'm either talking to young adults themselves who are kind of floundering and figuring out why isn't this story working out for me in the way that I hoped it would or the way that it was promised to me, whether by the church or by Hollywood or whomever they're taking their cues from. I'll talk to that audience, or I'll talk to the parents of young adults and the influencers of young adults who are, what is wrong with my son? Why is he still living at home at 28 years old? And I can't seem to get him out of our basement, and he can't land on a career, and he can't find a wife, and he can't. So somehow there's this divide between these generations, and I want you to shed a little bit of light on this. What's the difference between, as two individuals look toward marriage or even the possibility of it, what's the difference between just being a sinner and being broken and going into marriage, understanding that, with basically being unmarriable or at a point where you are not ready for marriage because of stuff that's either unresolved or just stuff that you have gone through? Or
oh, it just drives me mad. Mm-hmm. You know, like any person's ready, or a person's not being married because they're not ready. Mm-hmm. That's so presumptive on both sides that it just makes I could froth, but I won't. The bottom line is, people get married who are brilliant and who are beautiful and who are not. And who are mature and who are not. So I mean, it isn't a kind of algorithm that if I put the right things in, I'll find the right person. And because we operate, because I believe in God's sovereignty. On the other hand, I think you can have a mentality the church provides, like, well, don't think about this stuff. Just trust him, do the things of God, and things will work out wonderfully. Mm-hmm. I think that's as insane as well. So again, it's not like there's a right path, but if I were single right now, I would use social media. I would use dating services. I would ask friends. But what I'd also have to wrestle with is, do I want to be married? Thinking as a single person, not as a married person losing my spouse. In that case, it'd be like, oh no, I've had one long good shot at this. And the idea of doing it again, shoot me. Mm-hmm. but if I were single, I think I know that I would want to be married. I'd have to live with the fact that, I'm sorry, some people are literally called to die of pancreatic cancer. And this dear friend didn't want that, but that was his calling. Mm-hmm. How do we live well in whatever calling we have, and choosing not to get lost with the work of the accuser, bringing darkness and lies to us that are just foul with regard to what our face looks like, what our body looks like, what our desirability looks like. Mm-hmm. Because at the Seattle School, we have a lot of single women. We've got really gifted people. And their common complaint is this: it feels like I've got to dumb down. Mm-hmm. To hide, to make a man comfortable, that he's not getting too gifted, and the challenge will not be too great. Mm-hmm. And I think my response, though it's pretty easy for me to say this, is, oh, I beg of you, you know, don't. Marriage isn't worth it. Mm-hmm. To be able to hide your soul and your mind and your body, if that's the requirement. On the other hand, call men to be more. Mm-hmm. In every regard, call men to be more. So the slackers, the living in the basement, it isn't a matter of just being confrontational. It's a matter of saying you cannot be a man participating in the joy that you have available to you unless you're moving into initiating countless areas, not just relationally toward marriage, but many areas that I don't see you doing. So I do think we live as men where the word coward is a redundancy for the word man. Mm-hmm. But that's not true of your generation. It's true in unique ways. Mm-hmm. Of your generation. I think that's just as true in my generation, just as true for me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so frustrating for single women, though, because they see, I mean, I think they really believe that. And of course, we're kind of balancing between what we learned from now, which is basically the be all you can be and just go out there and do who you are, whatever. But at the same time, then we're called to a biblical femininity. And so, but in that, we're seeing practically play out experience after experience where the men are saying, well, you know, this is the way that this woman makes me feel. And it's, you know, it's kind of that men are drawn to women because of, you know, they make them feel more masculine, or they make them feel more powerful or more important or more, you know, sufficient or whatever. So I don't know. It's kind of, it's difficult. So I think a lot of women are thinking one thing in their head, but then they're seeing the reality played out a different way.
Yeah, and then marry him. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. find out what hell means. Mm-hmm. The real core is this, at least from my understanding of Genesis 3, every man's asking this core question, am I enough? Mm-hmm. And every woman is asking the question, am I too much? And those two intersect in a lot of tragedy, in a lot of heartache and failure. It's not going to go away generationally. Mm-hmm. Your children's children are going to be wrestling with this. If we live in a fallen world at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So how will we be in conversation together where I may be requiring of you to say, oh, you are more than enough. Oh, you are so... That's a lie. I am not enough. Mm-hmm. And so many women are requiring a man to be in a position to say, you'll never be alone. I'll be here for you. You'll never be alone. You aren't too much. And the answer is, my wife is too much. Mm-hmm. On so many levels. I just got a text in between what we were doing and now. And what she said to me was, she blessed me. And as soon as I started reading the first 5-6 words about her blessing from me, I didn't want to look at it. Hmm. In part because I was blushing. I was alone, but in the blush, it was like she was calling me to be even more of a man that I can be for the purposes of God. And I was like, I don't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. It's sweet words. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to hear it. So ambivalence. If we could only allow that word to actually intersect our conversations, male, female. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're ambivalent about one another. Of course, we're not sure, even though we're not in eighth grade at a school dance, in some ways, we still are. How will we together say, hey, we're on a first date. Feel like you're at an eighth grade dance? Mm-hmm. I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're having a very uncomfortable conversation with a man on a first date.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would it be like to say, can I ask you how uncomfortable you feel?
Mm-hmm.
Because I sure read you as uncomfortable. Now, does that make him more uncomfortable? If it does, even questions along the line of, how come? What's your life, your story? I don't want a therapist for a date. Well, mm-hmm. you got one, mm-hmm. and I ain't one. So that kind of freedom to play, to not be bound by a lot of the structures that, can I say this? Can I not say this?
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather come far more quickly into the forefront, and it will weed out many, but the few who will remain, those are people worth developing, not just friendships with, but to see where that relationship goes.
Hmm. So you are, we alluded to this earlier on, you're the parent of adult children, and one of them, I think, is married, right?
Yes.
Okay. So one married. How?
I'm sorry. What am I saying? Two are married.
Two are married now. Okay.
I married my son and daughter-in-law this summer.
Okay. Yes. One recently married. Okay. So two, one to go. One to move towards marriage, if that is in fact what God has for them. But what has been your process in guiding them into adulthood? And did you approach this, I mean, them as kids? Did you map this out? Did you say, okay, I'm anticipating the culture to be crazy. I have a lot of hopes for them, a lot of fears for them. And how kind of have you personally navigated that process?
My primary task was to protect them from Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've done a fairly good job of that. I had to protect them from being the children of a leader. Maybe not a very big fish, but a fish in a pond. And there were a lot of people there to devour my children mm-hmm. in one form or another. So,
and when you say protect them from Christianity, you mean just
madness,
the
craziness,
trappings of it and the expectations of you and your kids as a result.
Right. When my daughter hands me a book and says, so can I kiss on my first date?
Mm-hmm.
And I go, well, how courageous is the boy you're going out with? And she goes, not courageous at all. Tell me how you see that. She begins telling me stories, and I go, so okay, if a kiss happens on this first date, it's going to be because you generated it and because you made it very clear to him that you're available for that. So the kiss isn't the issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's the issue of, why are you already beginning to take care of men?
Mm-hmm.
I happened to hear one of the first dates she got asked out on, which included my wife and I gardening, while I heard the boy go, what are you doing this weekend? Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm studying, probably hanging out with friends. You want to go to a movie? And I'm thinking, oh no, don't answer that for him. He hasn't asked you.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least he didn't say, do you want to hang out? At least he identified a movie.
Same thing. What?
Even the phrase,
you want to hang out. The answer is, what she turned to him and she said, I'm very fond of movies. Are you asking? And he looked at her and went, I mean, literally goes, She goes, I will not make it easy for you. And he goes, well, would you go out with me to a movie? She said, I'd love to.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's what I need to prepare my daughters for. How do you deal with cowardice in a way that is not cruel, honoring, but inviting? So we had lots of conversations about that.
Mm-hmm.
And with my son, what does it mean to own your own cowardice and to engage with honor, with goodness, with maturing care for the other? You know, those are hard questions.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when it intersects with her sexuality,
mm-hmm.
One of the first conversations that my daughter began after my wife and my daughter, when she was 12, went off for the beginning conversation on sexuality. The first category that Becky said was, when we come home, you can ask your dad anything. So I'm sitting with my daughter, looking across from her. waiting for the first conversation, and she goes, so what are your views and practices of oral sex? And I'm going, shoot me. How do I become invisible so that I don't have to look at my daughter, who also is thrilled to make me uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm. Becky didn't give you a heads up on that then, huh?
No, she had told me that I was going to be in that. Any questions available?
Oh, okay.
You I just didn't expect that one.
Okay.
So all I can say is every parent's going to wrestle through all these questions. But if you have not created a context where you can talk about the issues that the children of my friends who are in fourth grade know about and actually probably 20 to 30% practice oral sex on a regular basis, mm-hmm. you're not going to have those conversations in what, until they're 12 to 14?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, which brings me to another question. We've talked about this a little bit here on the Boundless team, is how my personal frustration with everything that we talk about with abstinence, and it's all, we've got all these teen programs in churches and in schools, and we've got purity rings, and we've got all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I remember hearing that when I was about 14 or 15, but now I've had about 15 years of, you know, college, post-college, living on my own. How come no one's talking about this to young adults? And we're the ones with our own homes. We're the ones with time, with availability, with no accountability in some instances. And what do you think, I mean, as far as casting a vision just for sexuality? I mean, obviously, you know, you and I were talking before just about how marriage needs to be, this protracted singleness, you know, is ridiculous, and this getting no sex between your teen years and your 30s and whatever, and we're supposed to just think that's normal. And but what would you say, you know, what a vision for that, just for where singles are with sexuality?
Well, have the conversation and don't hide behind the, you know, straw man of abstinence. Mm-hmm. Am I committed to abstinence? Of course. Let's talk about a theology of sexuality that does a little better than just say no. It didn't work for Nancy Reagan and drugs, and it's not going to work for the Christian community. But the moment you do that, you already know we are now walking on the very hallowed sacred ground of powerful interest groups in Christianity, which for all those people who support abstinence, I want to turn to them and say, all right, tell us about 12. Tell us about masturbation for you at 12. 14, 16, 18. And when you were dating your wife, tell us about. Now, there are people who are perfectly pure, I suppose. But they were perfectly pure in thought. Really? They were able to pull that one off. I just want to say, every one of us struggles sexually before, during, and after. And if you think you can escape that by rings and covenants and so on and so forth, again, don't hear me poo-pooing that. I'm just saying you got to do more. I'm grateful my daughter put me on the spot, even if a portion of it was just the joy of watching her father sweat. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, you want to talk about oral sex? Okay, are you sure? Because I'll step into that with you, or are you just looking to make me uncomfortable? And she looked at me, and all of a sudden it dawned on her, at least at that age, it dawned on her, oh, my goodness, he's about to talk about this. And mm-hmm. and she started going, I don't want to hear. I don't want to know. I mm-hmm. don't want to know. And it's like, okay, but we're going to talk about sexuality for a lifetime. This isn't the one time we talk about this. We're going to talk about it for a lifetime and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So I think that freedom to go, no, you're going to struggle. Now, what will you do as you rise 25, 30, 30, and your sexuality, you know, in some ways is now at loss? How do we grieve? How do we deal with the shame? How do we talk about what does it mean to be sexual in our world? Is it only with regard to our primary, secondary sexual body parts? Is that it? Do you eat food erotically? Do you drink good drink erotically? Do you see and have conversations? Now, we haven't escaped the hard question you asked, but now at least what we're doing is saying we've got a lot bigger conversation to have. And why aren't we having it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what, Dan, just as we finish up here, another big, big question. I always love to get perspectives from folks who, you know, would be mentors to our audience, you know, personally and certainly publicly. But as you look at your own experience personally and as a counselor, as an author, just all that you've seen over the years, if you were to sit down with a couple, whether they're dating or not or considering dating, and you think of what they need to get to marriage, what really are the non-negotiables? I mean, I think we put up so many smoke screens and so many things of you have to be this, you have to know this at this point, you have to have gone through this class, you know, you have to do this premarital counseling. What is going to determine success in a marriage and get people there in a way that you personally would have confidence in that?
First category for me would be, what do you two do with shame? By being together, are you freer to step into stories and heartache where there's shame? Not that all those need to be done before you're married, but is there a growing freedom of, this is a human being who has seen some of my worst, past or present, and isn't naive about that, but also has a courage to be able to say, I have seen a hunger for redemption. I don't believe you will stay in this narrow hold of, but this is the way I am. So what I've said in that is several things. One, I've got to know you've got the courage to enter shame. I've got to know that you've got to be willing to grieve, but that you're also a man or woman of hope that really believes that redemption's true. So when that core is there, now, do you have sufficient lust for one another? And, you know, is there a kind of play of what the body brings, you know, technically called oxytocin? Is there enough oxytocin link that there's a kind of pleasure in being together that's both erotic, relational, spiritual, et cetera? I actually have interacted with a lot of couples who are mainstream good kids. And when I ask the question about how do you two deal with lust, they see it as, well, we protect ourselves by doing that, that, that. And I'm going, I'm all for that. Bless you for that. Yeah, but how's your lust for one another? Could it be a good thing? Yeah, It's a really sweet thing. So can you deal with shame? And is there the interplay of death and resurrection? Is there sufficient lust? And then do you have the ability to fight? Can you argue? And maybe it's a little bit too much. I'm of a Mediterranean descent, but can you yell at each other, cry, complain, and stay in it, and actually come to be humbled, to laugh, to be able to go, I don't agree with you. You don't agree with me. But we don't need to just compromise. We need to be able to go, I want to pick this one up again. There are conversations my wife and I have had for 35 years that are still, I think I'm gaining on her.
maybe.
Right. You're already well ahead. The point being, it's fun. We like arguing and we have fun reading scripture. And when I preached recently on Pentecost, and she goes, You're not telling people in this church what you really believe. And I'm going, well, maybe I'm just being wise. And she goes, all right, so let's talk about the difference between being wise and being a coward.
That's good. Yeah,
thanks a lot,
good.
Pal.
Yeah.
So you got those three, sufficient lust, capacity to fight, and there's something about shame that's dissipating. Not because it's just magically going away, but because we've stepped into one another's stories well enough that I am known, and I'm not just loved, I'm liked.
Well, great thoughts, Dan Allender. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Boundless Show. We will certainly have, as you will see on our blog post, links to more info about him and certainly the books that he's written, and you can check those out and get more information. So thanks so much for joining us, Dan.
You are welcome. My pleasure.